you know, it's pretty neat to think that John had just written 28 verses, 28 straight verses of Jesus talking. With verses like 23 and 28 of chapter 5. 23, 28, 37, 38, 45. I mean, those are powerful verses. And as I was looking at that and thinking, a man couldn't just come up with this stuff. You know, this ought to be, I felt like as I was studying, it just seemed like, man, this is, how could someone not think that this was inspired writings? So, with question number one, help me out, Lauren. I can't remember what...
Dennis answered the last question.
Okay. Grant, if you'd like question number one. When are these events taking place in the ministry of Christ? That's verses 1 through 4.
There's regular information for us. When does it take place? Verses 1 through 3, we need verse 4. You see, it's near the Passover time. And as far as I can understand, the first Passover during Jesus' ministry portion is in chapter 5, verse 1. That's kind of the first Passover for Jesus' ministry. This is the second one. This should be at the beginning of the second year.
Yeah, I had another Passover, that Passover in chapter 2, verse 13, when he cleansed the temple. And I kind of like, well, was this the beginning of his ministry or not? Discussion, anyone got any thoughts on that? Lord?
So I have it as, I think what you had was chapter 2, 13, the first one, 5, 1, the second one, 6, 4, the third, which is this one, and 13, 1, 4. So if that's correct, but I think in 5:1 it never really specified.
Yeah, there was debate.
Right, but if that scenario is correct, this is 1 year after chapter 5 and 1 year before his death.
Right, so depending on what that Passover in chapter 5, or that feast in chapter 5 was. Scholars were split, but I think most of them did believe that it was the Passover. Awesome.
Most people believe that this is, that the one in chapter 5 is referencing the Passover, and again, if that's the case, then this would be the start of his third year in his ministry, give or take, of course. And most refer to this third year as the year of opposition. We were leaving the year of popularity, and now we're entering into the year of opposition. And we start to see the opposition. This is kind of the pinnacle and also the decline of his popularity, as it were. And we won't see the decline until the end of chapter 6. So it's right within the context of these events that this shift in his popularity takes place. Yeah.
I've got a Bible that kind of lays out the year of inauguration, the year of popularity, the year of the opposition, and then it's got another section last month and the last days. So that's been a little bit helpful. Anyone else on question number one? All right, question number two. Trace, if you'd like it, why did Jesus ask Philip where they could buy bread? And why did Jesus want to feed the multitudes? And this is verses 5 and 6.
Okay. Well, I would say for the first part, they had been following him for quite some time. And there's a lot of people, 5,000 men, and not counting their spouses or their children. So that's a lot of people to feed. So he was worried, I would say he was concerned for their physical well-being, but also for their spiritual well-being. I say for their physical well-being because if you turn to Matthew 14:14, you can see that he also healed their sick. And but I would say for their spiritual well-being, not trying to touch on any of the other questions, but for their spiritual well-being, because, obviously it's to glorify God because he feeds obviously a miracle. So
yeah, that's right. Very good. Anyone else on question number two? Yeah, Bart.
Well, the Lord is testing, as tells us, the Lord is testing Philip, as God does with his servants. All of us are tested by God. Abraham, of course, most famously, Genesis 22 says, and God tested Abraham and said, go up on the mountain. And we briefly talked, I'm sure people could think of a whole bunch of other biblical patriarchs who were tested, but Lot was tested, Joseph was tested, Jacob was tested. And so Jesus here is testing Philip, whether or not Philip's seen countless miracles at this point. The reason this multitude is following him is because they want healing. There's individuals of, imagine the ancient world, how terrible conditions were. They had no medicine. They didn't have a neurologist like Dakota to take care of their conditions. And so they don't have a pathologist to diagnose it even. So, terrible conditions are happening, and this man is able to cure them. Of course they're going to follow him across Galilee and watch him. And so Philip's seen countless miracles, and yet he's unable to think that God can create food on the spot. And so Jesus asked him, where shall we buy bread? And I think the best answer would have been for Philip to have said, Isaiah said, come to God and buy wine and milk without money and without price.
Very good.
So Jesus is referencing the Old Testament. You buy bread from God. Where else can we go but to you for bread? And Philip doesn't have that.
Yeah. Good. Very good passage. Very good passage. Anyone else? Austin?
I was thinking about kind of practical application. Of course, it says that the Lord is testing it here. And Philip, to his credit, does come up with a solution, but so many times, like us, the Lord gives us opportunity to put our faith in him, and the solutions we come up with sometimes don't even include him in it. And such was the case with Philip here. He had a solution. Well, we could buy, all this bread or however much, 200 denarii worth of bread, and we could give them each a little bite, but forgetting that the Lord of creation was sitting right next to him. So he tried, and he had a solution, but it didn't include the Lord, and that's something for us to remember too.
Yeah, very good. Isn't it, Lauren, you had your hand up, I think.
For the last part of the question, why did Jesus want to feed the multitudes? Trace pointed out he had compassion, but then as we look to the latter part of the chapter, this sets up the teaching of the latter part of the chapter.
Right,
spiritual nature.
Yeah. Mark?
Yeah, and along those lines, John is setting this up for us so that we see that Jesus is replicating the deeds of Moses. And in the last chapter, at the end of the chapter, Jesus said, it is Moses who accuses you. It is Moses, not I, it is Moses who accuses you. You're not following after your own patriarch. And so Moses instituted the Passover in Exodus 12, took the people into the wilderness and fed them manna from heaven. Jesus goes up on a mountain, just like Moses went up on a mountain at the time of Passover, and then feeds the people. So Jesus is better than Moses. He is the Moses of the new covenant.
Yeah, that's excellent point. I thought it was interesting that John recorded this little tidbit of information here. It's not much, but boy, it sure does open up some things. Jesus knew Philip's mind, so why the need to ask? And maybe for the benefits of the others that were around to be able to hear a bit of this conversation, or maybe for Philip's benefit specifically for some reason. We don't know all those details. Trace pointed out the compassion that Jesus had on the multitude, healing their sick. Verse 15 of Matthew 14, the apostles, the other solution, Austin, was telling Jesus to send them away. Send them all away. Find food in the villages. And Jesus obviously had a different plan. I had to be reminded of this. I didn't stick in my head from previous studies over the years, But this is the only other miracle that's recorded in all four Gospels. So this is really important. And for all four Gospels to record it, there's probably some uniqueness in this that we're still not realizing. The resurrection, obviously, being the other. And then think about this teaching moment, as Jesus has done many times. He's taking these loaves and this bread, and whether he lifts it up to heaven or lifts his hands to heaven, but he speaks to God, offering a blessing. And there would be a certain amount of people within earshot, and maybe from the hillside on the mountain, and on calm nights, calm evenings, that sound carries really well. So maybe a lot of people heard Jesus giving this blessing, and then were able to see the 12 baskets that were gathered up. Boy, wouldn't that make an impression on you? Anyone else on question number two? Question number three, Lauren, if you would like it. How large was this crowd? How much money would it have taken to feed them? Are there any lessons to be learned from the boy that came with 5 loaves and 2 fish? Yes.
How large was the crowd? Verse 10 says 5,000 men, so that total's likely 3 to 4 times that, so probably 15 to 20,000 people is estimating. How much would it have cost to feed them? Philip says it would have taken more than 200 denarii. So Matthew 29 shows that as a day's wages, basically. So that's 200 days' wages. Today, if we're working here, that's approximately 250 work days. So this is 80% of a year's wages. If you figure 80% of 40,000, that's 32 grand. Or if it's a $5 lunch times 15,000, that's $75,000. So somewhere between $32,000 and $75,000 in today's money. What can we learn from the boy that came with 5 loaves and 2 fish? Always pack lunch. Second, share. Third, you can give to the Lord, and it will often produce many times that. Fourth, barley is a poor man's food, so this boy was probably poor, and even the poor can give and it can be used.
Yeah, very good. Excellent. Anyone got anything to add to that? Austin?
Not much, but it strikes me that it's only this boy who manages to pack a lunch, and amongst so many, it's the only one who was actually prepared to follow the Lord that day was this lad here. And there's preparation involved in that. Yeah. I was also thinking, I love Lauren's example there of how much it would take. In my mind's eye, I was trying to think about this crowd, 15, 20,000 people, and having them all line up at a restaurant. And then one by one, they go past the cash register, and just feeling that in your back pocket and thinking about how much that total would be, looking at this vast crowd, and then, of course, we know what the Lord is able to do with 5 loaves and 2 fish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent. Anyone else? I would suggest that certainly no one thought this little boy mattered or what was in his basket significant, and we never know which little person God will use and how. Anything else? Let's look at number four. Malin, if you'd like it, why might Jesus have chosen to multiply the loaves and fish as opposed to creating food from nothing? What are some lessons to be learned from this miracle? That's verses 11 through 14.
Show that it doesn't take much. If he just needs a little bit, he can do great things. We've kind of already talked about. And then, yeah, if you're willing to give up a little bit, he can take control of it all. So I guess what are some lessons to be learned? Jesus certainly provides for his own. Jesus can use whatever small amounts that we bring. He can make something great. Just kind of being prepared.
Anyone else? Good. Thank you. Lord?
As you already pointed out earlier, he gave thanks for this. But we prayed for it, and they gave thanks for it, and it showed the importance of giving thanks to God, even when what there is doesn't appear to be enough. So, you know, it's an important thing to always be thankful for what you have.
Yep, that's right. I kind of found myself trying to visualize what was going on here. To multiply the loaves and the fish, to me, was more visual. It would be more visual to his apostles, but it would be more visible to the crowd. And I'm envisioning them kind of down a hill into a pasture, into a meadow. There was grass, so there was evidently relatively comfortable places to sit. But think about the boy with this little amount of food and people around. I'm still into this people overhearing conversations, and then this idea as conversation and word got around about this little boy's got some food. Then I'm thinking that message is getting down the hill. It's grapevining its way down the hill, and the crowd is murmuring and hearing some of these things and wondering what's going to happen. And again, Jesus asked a blessing out loud for this meager amount of food and then these amazing results. I think that's the impression for me. Anyone else? Awesome.
I agree with everything that's been said, but I want to kind of focus in on the fact that he told them to gather up the fragments so that nothing was lost. And the fact that you wouldn't think that here in this particular story, a historical account of Jesus multiplying food, that frugality is on his mind. But perhaps a lesson for us, when the Lord provides us more than we need, don't throw it away, don't waste it. You can still use that, but maybe for another time. So even with all that the Lord provides, gather up the fragments so that nothing is lost.
Did anyone else come across, I can't remember where I was reading, but it was suggested that these fragments contain demons. I've not heard that before, and I don't remember where I come across it. But it sounded like, yeah, that could be something that the Pharisees, some rule that the Pharisees could throw out there. But the idea that showing that these fragments were okay to collect and reuse, just out there. I came across that and couldn't come across it a second time. And then the other idea is, Jesus has had a run-in. Chapter 5 had a significant run-in, although maybe a year earlier, with the religious establishment. And do you think the religious establishment might have some spies in this group that maybe were, or maybe the religious establishment were watching from a distance, and now they think, okay, you got 5,000 plus people out there in the desert, so to speak, with no food. Now what are you going to do? And boy, turn the tables on. If they were watching or had spies, imagine being a spy in that group and then going back and telling your bosses what you saw. That would be phenomenal. Anything else on question number 4? Okay, let's look at number 5. Logan, if you'd like, question number 5, why did they want to make Jesus their king? Why didn't Jesus accept the role being thrust upon him? That's verse 15.
Just in the previous verse 14, it says, "Then those men, when they had seen, this is truly the prophet who has come to the world." So they see these works, and they're already following Jesus. They're already interested in what he has to say. And so when he does this, and this confirms in their mind, you know, I would think your average Jew in that time was trained to look for the Messiah, or at least heard of the Messiah, right? And they're looking for these things. They're looking for signs like this. So they see this, and they're ready to make him the king. As for the second part of the question, why didn't Jesus accept this role? This doesn't fit his mission, you know. This isn't what he came to do. He's the king that served men on earth, you know.
Yeah.
And, it would just go against absolutely everything he came to accomplish. You know, the Pharisees are the ones who want a conqueror. They want a militant leader. And Jesus just isn't going to accept it and have it that way. I thought of that Ivan Costa song. about the death of Uriah. I think you led it for the very first time.
I haven't led it yet, but I love it.
Oh, okay. Well, the first verse, you know, Uriah dies for his king. The second verse is about, you know, our king dying for us. Mm-hmm. What king on earth has ever done that? So.
Yeah, very good, very good. Anyone else? Awesome.
Agree with everything Tobin said. It's interesting, they start viewing Jesus now, instead of the Savior, they start viewing him really as a servant. Because if you're going to, Jesus isn't asking to be king, so they're going to take him by force and make him a king. Why? Because he can heal their sick, and now we see that he can make food.
Yeah.
He can multiply food. So that's all you want out of a leader, right? Is somebody who can take care of your every whim and every need. So in a sense, they're almost viewing him like a servant, like some kind of all-purpose factory that can just give them whatever they want, and basically they'll take care of the rest. As long as you provide the goods, we'll fight the battles and so on and so forth. Perhaps they thought maybe he'd be out front, but he hasn't shown that, so it seems that they're only looking on a physical standpoint. And then, you know, why didn't Jesus accept the role? It's similar to the deal that the devil offered him when he was being tempted. He offered him all the kingdoms and all the things that he could see. And of course, he turned that down because that would be a physical kingdom. Jesus didn't come here to be a physical king. He came to rule the hearts of men, not the governments that man created.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Anyone else? Question number 5. I wondered, too, several writers were suggesting that this large group of people were on their way to Jerusalem from different directions. So there was a lot of people coming across the countryside, and when they were finding out that Jesus was healing, then people would obviously then bring their family members that might be struggling. But the Passover's coming up. We know the Passover's coming up. I couldn't tell how soon. But there's people coming, and maybe these 5,000, here's this new prophet that look what he's done, and this is right before Passover. Maybe this is culminating, and this is going to be the big event for Passover. Now we're going to take control, and we're going to throw off the yoke of Roman bondage. And no, that wasn't the plan, was it? It wasn't time yet. And it does appear that the disciples were kind of getting caught up in this, because Jesus had to send them away. He told them, go across the sea. He sent them across. Matthew and Mark record that. He sent them away to the other side. Anything else on question number 5? Question number 6. Bart, what can we learn about Jesus from walking on the water in this account?
Well, as you say, Jesus sent the disciples away. Over Matthew 14, we have one of the parallel chapters. He made them go away. They didn't want to. And then he went to the mountain to pray, and then night fell and a storm arose. And in Matthew, we're told this is where Peter walks on the water. So the disciples see Jesus walking to them on the water in the middle of the night, and they're afraid. And Jesus says, "Do not be afraid, it is I." And Peter says, "If it is you, bid me come." And, you know, I remember a Stanley Elmore sermon when I was a teenager on that very subject. And so what is he showing them? Well, he has been healing the sick and making the paralytics walk, and he's been feeding, creating food out of nothing, and now he shows his control and mastery of nature. Moses divided the Red Sea, but Jesus walks on Galilee, so he's a greater than Moses. He can walk, literally walk on water. And I found two verses that speak to this, that if the disciples knew them, they might have thought of them. Psalm 107, verse 24, or 29, "He calms the storm so that its waves are still." And over in the book of Job, speaking of God, it says, "He commands the sun, it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He spreads out the heavens, and he treads on the waves of the sea." And so maybe they thought of Job as they were lying down that night to sleep. Now Job said that God walks on the waves.
Yeah, that's a great thought. Yeah, interesting. Anyone else? Question number six. Apologize, I meant to be speaking louder. Hopefully you can hear me well enough. I'm trying to project. Yeah, power over nature, power over physics. Here's a couple of things. I can't remember if it was Matthew, Mark, or Luke's account where Jesus saw them out in the water struggling. So we've got high winds, it's dark, the waves are crashing, and Jesus is still able to see them. And we can take comfort in that, knowing that he sees us when we're struggling as well. Today, people need to be looking for Jesus. Excuse me, the truth in religion. Do not be afraid to call on Jesus. As Bart pointed out, Peter called out. And then Mark chapter 6 and verse 48. It appears that Jesus would have walked on by them had they not called out. And that's an interesting point where Jesus wants people to come unto him. The Lord wants people to come unto him, to be looking for the truth, looking for what the Lord wants them to do, as opposed to, I got this feeling in my heart that I needed to go to church today, type of experience. And we got to be willing to receive Jesus and his gospel. Anything else? Lauren?
Mark 6:52 says, "For they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened." And then back in Matthew 14:33, says, "And then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, Truly you are the Son of God." So this, at this point, it fully convinced all of them of who he was. Jesus sent them out there knowing this would happen. So he sent them into hardship to change their minds.
That's a good point. I like that. Yeah. So I guess the applicant, we're going to have hardships, aren't we, that we have to work through. Anything else? Very good. Appreciate the participation of everyone.